Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. I'm very well. I'm super well. I'm as well can be because, ladies and gentlemen, something incredible happened in my life. Just want to tell you about it before we get on with the show. Something amazing, something unprecedented, something that I just couldn't get my head around. I couldn't imagine it ever happening. Arsenal won a game of football. Okay, come on, be honest. All of us, we're desperate for our team to win. We want Arsenal to do well and to succeed and to win football matches. But hands up, how many of you thought we were going to go to Milan and win 2-0, keep a clean sheet in the San Siro? How many? Look, you over there, just put your hand down. You didn't believe that for 1 second. You're just trying to look smart after the fact. Football is so weird, isn't it? It is just the strangest thing because I was not confident going into this game because we'd been so poor. I was hopeful. You know what I hoped? I hoped that because of the fact the Europa League was the thing that we've got left this season, that somehow there would be a response from these players, that we would see something that was much more approaching what we know they're capable of. You know, for all the frustration, for all the anger that we have about the way they've been playing or the way they've been managed and everything else, we know that these are players who are capable of a lot better than we've seen over the last couple of weeks. So my hope was, whatever the result, that we would see something more from these Arsenal players, both in terms of the tangibles and the intangibles. And what I mean is the intangibles like desire and passion is not the right one, but certainly energy and commitment on the pitch, because we can read those. Even if we can't necessarily measure them, we can read them to a certain extent. But also the ability to play some football, the ability to stay organized, defensively in particular, if we could see something of that in this game, I would have been encouraged. That's what I was hoping for, and that, thankfully, is what we got. And to come away after 90 minutes with a clean sheet and two goals, two first-half goals, one from Henrik Mkhitaryan, one from Aaron Ramsey, which puts us in a great position for the second leg next week. You know, it was better than I hoped. It was really better than I thought it was going to go. And it's nice, isn't it? Doesn't it feel good that we don't have to talk about why were we so bad? Why were we so tactically inept? Why wasn't the level of commitment from the players there? Why did they look like they were going through the motions? We don't have to do that today. We don't have to do that. We don't have to think about it. It doesn't mean that all our problems are solved or anything like it, but just for the first time in a while, it's nice to enjoy an Arsenal performance and an Arsenal result. And if you can't be up for a 2-0 win away from home against AC Milan, then I don't know what to say to you. I really enjoyed it. I know they still had their moments. They had some moments of danger in the game, Milan had, and they could have perhaps scored a goal in the second half. The guy blasted over the bar, and there was a moment in the first half, wasn't there? Ospina came for a cross and missed it. The guy headed wide. But look, we could have scored more as well. Well, I think Mkhitaryan should have scored at least one more goal. There was the chance he had early on, which he hit in the side netting, and scored a good goal. Got a bit of a deflection, but the one that hit the bar. You know, we had our moments. We really looked a bit more like ourselves. We looked a bit more like Arsenal, and that's pleasing and it's encouraging, and hopefully we can kick on from here. But because of the Thursday night thing, the fact we're not kicking off until 6 o'clock, meaning I've got to do work and then kick off the podcast a bit later, I'm not going to do too much waffling. I'm just going to get on with the show. And joining me to discuss what is practically a historic event at this point, Arsenal winning a game, Paolo Bandini, hello.
An Arsenal win away from home, no less.
An Arsenal win away from home in the San Siro, no less, as well. It's not a bad way to break your duck. I know we beat Östersunds away from home recently, but this is a slightly different beast. How confident or not were you going into this one, Paolo?
Not at all, really. I think you look at the fact that Milan have certainly been playing better at the start of this year. I had some questions about whether Milan were a complete team ready to win this sort of game, but they were unbeaten in 13 games. They hadn't conceded in something like 10 hours. They were playing well, and Arsenal weren't, let's be honest about it. Four consecutive defeats against a team that's 13 games unbeaten? No, it's hard to feel confident at that point. So I was pretty surprised by how the first half went.
I'm not going to put this down to a bad Milan performance, but they certainly didn't look like a team that had been on such a good run, and conversely, Arsenal didn't look like a team that had been on such a bad run. There was quite a bit of to and fro in the opening stages of the game in particular. Arsenal started relatively slowly, and there were some corners for Milan to put a bit of pressure on, but I thought they might dominate us a bit more than they did early on, and Arsenal at least came out and looked to play.
No, it was interesting because before the game you had both managers sort of basically saying no, he's the one you should be talking to, because Wenger said, well, I don't think I can be offering any advice to Gattuso as a young manager, given that his team's winning and mine's not. And Gattuso described himself as un pulcino, which is a word which is used for the sort of youngest age categories of football in Italy. It literally means like a little chick, but it's used for the kids games, basically saying in managerial terms that's what he was, a little chick. And I think actually that is kind of what came to bear in this game. I think that Wenger, for all that he hasn't got right recently, he understands the tactical nuance of a game like this a lot better than Gattuso does. I think Gattuso lined Milan up. I mean, he didn't do anything particularly different to what he's been doing in his recent league games, but I think there was a very naive approach in the way they thought they were going to get at Arsenal. I think they'd made a fairly logical step in thinking that Chambers and Kolasinac, these are your two weak links in the side, these are the places you need to get at Arsenal. But I think he really thought that he was going to be able to set the tone and get pressure on them early with Hakan Çalhanoğlu and Suso on the flanks. And as a result, you saw both those players very high up the pitch. You have two relatively, well, I mean, Calabria is 21 years old, Rodriguez is a little bit older at 25, but still two fairly inexperienced fullbacks and fullbacks who themselves are often keen to get up the pitch, left very exposed, getting very little support as well from the midfield. Three, Bonaventura and Kessié really didn't drift out to help them, and Arsenal just absolutely took advantage of that. I think that was exactly where the game was won for me. There was obviously other things that went on, especially in the second half, just in terms of managing the game. But what Arsenal did in the first half was see those gaps, see where Milan were overcommitting, and played those spaces superbly. I mean, just got in behind those two fullbacks,
particularly down the left hand side. Arsenal's left hand side, Milan's right hand side. We had a lot of joy, and Kolasinac is a guy who hasn't really been playing particularly well in recent weeks and months, but he had a very good performance tonight. I thought very strong. He was composed, he was good on the ball, created some danger. Final ball, I think, could have been a bit better at times, but there was real success for Arsenal from an attacking point of view. It was very pleasing to see that some of the combination play that's been so missing from what we've done in recent weeks seemed to return.
Yeah, I mean, the first goal in particular was such a lovely ball from Ozil.
Yeah.
So well taken from Mickey. And I think that's exactly what he was doing a lot, I guess, in this competition last season for Manchester United. So nice to see him doing it for us in this competition. It felt very easy for Arsenal in that first half. It felt like all those passes were coming off. The space was there and they were exploiting it, which, again, is that little bit of experience of players like Ozil and Mkhitaryan knowing that when that space is there, knowing how to exploit it. And I think the big difference there between the sort of way other teams treat Arsenal in the Premier League compared to how Milan treated them. I think in the Premier League, they haven't been allowed that sort of time on the ball and the space to find those gaps, whereas Milan were just far too gentle in sitting off a player like Ozil, and then far too naive in the space that they allowed players, including Mkhitaryan, to get in behind.
Mkhitaryan could have scored a couple, hit the bar, of course. He probably should have scored there, and he probably should have scored or at least got a shot on target earlier on, which hit the side netting. But, I mean, do you think in some ways Milan were a little bit lulled into a false sense of security by how poor Arsenal have been in recent times? Because if you watch them against Brighton, if you watch them against Östersunds, if you watch them in the away games against Swansea, against Bournemouth, there just didn't seem to be anywhere anything approaching the kind of bite or attacking incision that people normally associate with Arsenal. So when Milan went into this game, perhaps planning what they're going to do, and having watched Arsenal, I'm sure, and having studied some of the games, they might have perhaps underestimated what we were capable of, because basically we haven't seen it for so long.
Yeah, I think that's definitely plausible to me. And I think that, especially when, again, you're talking about, it's quite a young Milan team. We're so used to the great Milan teams were often some of the oldest teams competing in the Champions League back in their heyday. They went to Champions League finals with teams with an average age of over 30. And here you had four players who were 21 and under. And I think that it was interesting to me, just the body language of Donnarumma after that first goal went in. He kind of had this face on, like, oh, I won't say what I was going to say, but yeah, oh, come on, I'm not going to concede a goal to this lot this early. And it just looked like he almost really like was stung by it, like insulted by it. What are we doing letting this happen? And I think that was, there was a little bit of entitlement about them, that maybe they just thought that this was going to be a game, a big game, and a game that they could win, and a game that was going to sort of be another step in their development. And it completely went the other way. I think there was definitely a naivety about me. And I suppose I feel, as I'm saying that, maybe I've done a bit too much talking up the naivety and the overconfidence of Milan, and maybe not enough praise for Arsenal, because I think, look, it was a very good performance nonetheless, and it doesn't just sort of, it's not just because Milan were bad, Arsenal were good tonight.
No, I'm absolutely taking nothing away from that, and I think Arsenal were good tonight. I think it's kind of worth exploring, though, because you talked about Gattuso as a novice manager. He is still a very young manager and new at the game, and perhaps as part of his learning curve to realize that despite the fact your team has been on a 13-game unbeaten run, that it can change very quickly if you get a bit comfortable there on the other side of that. How do we analyze what we got from Arsenal tonight compared to what we've seen from Arsenal in recent weeks, where everything has been so pedestrian, it's been so labored, the players have looked like they're going through the motions? Arsene Wenger got more out of his team tonight, and there wasn't much that he did differently in terms of the team selection, because you look at the squad and you think, well, how can he change it in any significant way with no Aubameyang for Europa League? Lacazette is injured. We made so many changes from our attacking options in January, with Giroud gone, Sanchez gone, Walcott gone. There isn't the same scope for rotating his squad. So what was so different about tonight? Do you think it could have been just the occasion, that not only just the weight of criticism and the need to start performing again, but we also have a group of players who realize that they're 13 points behind fourth place. They're not going to get into the Champions League via the Premier League unless something absolutely miraculous happens. And I can't see that. I don't think anybody can really see that. But the Europa League provides them with a chance for silverware. And we've often seen it, haven't we, where a team that is in the doldrums domestically or in the league can get themselves up and focus on a cup competition, because it is the thing that can provide them with something tangible at the end of the season.
I think exactly that. I think there was definitely a sense of urgency tonight, which I think has definitely been missing in the last couple of Premier League games. It's kind of harder to look at what happened in the Carabao Cup final and say, hey, that was a lack of urgency. I think you can't be in a cup final and not realize that it's an important game that you need to win. But I think certainly there was maybe a little bit of a feeling in that home game against City of defeatism from the outset. Like, this was a game that Arsenal didn't believe they could win because of the hammering they'd just taken from City, and maybe didn't feel like it mattered anymore if they could win these games, because what is it worth in the league? It's not going to get them up to the top four at this point, and it's frankly, they can, at the rate things are going, afford to continue to lose a lot of games and still not necessarily drop out of the Europa League places. So there isn't an awful lot else left to play for. And it did feel like tonight, from the beginning, this game had just a lot more edge to it, a lot more edge to it than certainly in some performances lately. I suppose when you looked at the second half of the Brighton game, I think maybe some of that came back, and maybe there was just a bit of a pride reaction in the second half of that game as well. But it did feel like, I don't know, it's always hard to sort of separate the fan perspective and the player perspective on these things, but it did feel like a bit of a make or break night for Arsenal. And I think there was some reaction from players who, you know, again, you can sort of speculate about what the reasons for it are. Is it about professional pride and just, well, we haven't played well enough in recent games? Is it about actually the individual respect and affection and feeling of not wanting to let down the manager who has been there for so long, even next year, which is the Champions League, and we know this is the only way to do it? Or is it just the simple fact of being at San Siro? And I think that's, you know, not to be underestimated either. I think you had this sort of perfect storm to a certain extent, in that you got the occasion, you got the sense of being at one of the great European venues in front of a crowd of more than 70,000 people, of this being an epic European night. And yet at the same time, Arsenal didn't really have to contend with an epic European opponent, certainly on the night, in terms of what Milan were able to produce from their performance. So it was kind of a perfect storm in that regard. But I definitely don't think anyone at the club can be unaware at this point that this is all that's left. That this is the only way to make something of this season and to make it into a positive season. And look, not just that there's a chance of doing it, but that Arsenal really still at this point should be looking at this and thinking we are one of the favourites in this tournament. I mean, Dortmund, you would look at as one of the other teams who are supposed to be front runners. They lost at home to Salzburg tonight, so if they go out, then that's one less of the big teams who are left in this competition. And Napoli have already gone out. Lazio, at the time I'm talking to you, are drawing 1-1 at home to Kiev, so again, another of the big teams not especially doing well. Atletico Madrid are clearly the other team in the competition who you look at and think, right, that's the team who are to beat. But there aren't many teams in this competition that Arsenal should be looking at and feeling inferior to, so it has to mean a lot. It has to be the thing that they're clinging to. So I guess it's that sort of thing of not wanting to turn it into a cliche, but yeah, to me it looked like a performance of a team that knew this is what was left to them.
Yeah, and I think as well we've got to look at it from the point of view of we can get quite granular and analyze results and performances to the nth degree, but I think the players will come away tonight from that game and go home and think, we went to Milan and we won 2-0 and we kept a clean sheet, and that is perhaps just the tonic that they need after such a bad period. I do wonder sometimes if we as fans, when things are going badly, we find it very hard to look beyond that it becomes the be-all and end-all. And I'm not saying that what's gone on in recent weeks has been in any way over the top. I don't think the reaction has been hugely over the top, because it has been really, really bad. But we can lose sight perhaps of the fact that it quite often doesn't take much to turn things around again, that it can be just one game that can reinstall or reinvigorate a team and its belief in itself. And you could see elements of that coming back tonight. For example, I thought Granit Xhaka, who's a guy who's been certainly in the firing line this season for his performances, I thought he was absolutely excellent. I thought he passed the ball very well, defensively switched on throughout. And when you go to somewhere like Milan, you want the guy, perhaps your deepest lying midfielder, to be really, really secure. And he was. I think he made more passes than any other Arsenal player. He passed it with a 95% completion rate. And it's on those kind of things that victories like that are built.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was probably the player who just touched the ball the most in that Arsenal midfield. I think he was certainly the player who felt like he was on the ball the most for Arsenal. And look, what you were talking about there in terms of the feel-good factor, it's a thing which I feel like I've been talking about a lot recently that people still sort of refuse to see that football players are, as much as we want them to be, as professionals, constantly committed and constantly playing at their absolute highest, for the simple reason that they're remunerated in an absolutely extraordinary way, they are still, in the end, human beings and subject to the same sort of emotional ups and downs that everyone else is in their job. Mm. And you do something professionally, you do it full time, it is a job, no matter how much money you're making for it. And I think that's the thing about, again, going somewhere like San Siro. It's that thing of, in your day job, you don't do this every week. You don't go, you do go to, you know, obviously you don't literally go to Brighton every week, but you go to places like Brighton most weeks. You know, you're always traveling around England and playing in stadiums that are sort of familiar, playing against teams that play in ways that are sort of familiar. When you go somewhere like Milan, it's an opportunity to break out of a rhythm. It's an opportunity to take yourself out of that grind, I guess, and be reminded of, wait, this is really fun. This is going to play football somewhere that's one of the places that maybe when I was a kid I would have looked at and thought, wow, a dream to play there someday. And I think that just enthusiasm is underestimated sometimes in football. I think when footballers are having fun, it becomes a game again. It becomes the thing which you always wanted to do and that you just enjoy. And that is something that's been desperately missing, I think, at Arsenal lately, that sense of players going out and enjoying themselves. I think people have been stepping onto the pitch weighed down by the fact that they're not playing up to their level. I think they've been going onto the pitch probably weighed down by everything that's happening off the pitch, from the constant speculation about the manager, which, look, I think you know my feelings on this by now, and it's been for a little while, the thought of, yes, the club needs to move on and how to do it in an elegant way. And I think that sense of stasis around the club and the constant endless talk about the manager, of course it affects the players. So this is an opportunity to break that rhythm, I guess, an opportunity to be in a just a different mindset for a few days. And of course you now really hope that they can carry that back and make that the rhythm of the rest of the season instead of what it has been up to now.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's two home games coming up now. We've got Watford on Sunday. I think there's probably an element of revenge required against Watford. You remember when we played them earlier in the season, I think it was Troy Deeney who came out afterwards and sort of spouted, I can't remember what it was he said exactly, but it was questioning the character of the Arsenal players because he won a header when he came on. And ultimately he was able to make that kind of assessment of things because Arsenal capitulated in that game and lost a winning position. And then you have another game against AC Milan where it feels almost as if the fans need something like this as well, don't they? That,
oh yeah,
you know, the Manchester City game, the cold, the snow, the weather, and we look at that as an excuse for a half-empty Emirates Stadium. But it feels to me like a big night against AC Milan, going into the game with two away goals and a clean sheet from the first leg. They're going to have to come and have a go, which might just very well suit Arsenal and the players that we've got. And if we can win, whether it's a 1-0 or 2-0 against AC Milan next week, it could help spark a revival, not just in terms of what it does for the players, but also for the fans, and give them really something to believe in. Because if we beat Milan next week, you're in the quarterfinals, and you're five games away from a trophy. And Arsenal, in the last number of years, have had a very good record in cup competitions and have experience in cup competitions, which I think is undervalued at times. That, you know, there's an up and a down of being a cup side. You know, it speaks to perhaps a weakness somewhere else, but it's a strength in these competitions, and that could be a good thing going forward.
Right, and I mean, look, from a fan perspective, I mean, I don't need to tell you this because you understand it as well as I do. But, you know, last year, the cup final win over Chelsea was literally one of my favorite days of all of 2017. I mean, that was just a tremendous... I don't mean that's just in a footballing sense. I just mean when I think about 2017 as a year, what days stick out as great days? What a tremendous day. It was a wonderful day. So, of course, as a fan, the cup competition, the opportunity to make something fun out of this season again. Again, it's that word fun for me. It's that word that I think has been so desperately missing from so much of the Arsenal experience. And I'd say that for players or fans in the last sort of, I was going to say 12 months, but maybe it's more than 12 months. There's been so much time spent in this infuriating stasis, this infuriating sense of a club that is not progressing, that is sort of gradually sliding back and doing so in the most predictable way possible, always playing the same games and getting the same sorts of letdowns, the same sorts of mistakes that cost them and stop them from moving forwards as a club. The thing that gives you an escape from that is the cup competition. The only escape for that for Arsenal has been cup competitions, but it has been a pretty good regular escape. Now, the Europa League is something new, which almost makes it more fun. Obviously, any Arsenal fan would prefer that we were doing this in the Champions League rather than the Europa League. But again, just that sense of difference, that sense of doing something completely outside what you are used to doing is... I don't know. It generates enthusiasm. It makes you want to go to games rather than, let's be perfectly blunt about it, how a lot of fans felt about the home league game against Man City, where, sure, it was incredibly cold, but I think a lot of people just couldn't really summon the enthusiasm even to get down to the game after the way the team had been playing. Mm.
Do we have, tenure as Milan manager has been very short, so do we have any idea how Gattuso will react to this? Is this the first real setback he's had during his time there? Because he's come in, obviously had a very positive influence, only took over in November, and if he's 13 games unbeaten, there can't be much experience of a setback or of a defeat, particularly in a game where I guess they were, I won't say banking on winning, but they would have been very confident of taking a lead into the second leg.
They did have some setbacks right at the beginning. He didn't actually get off to an immediately successful start. They were thumped 3-0 by Verona in December. So actually, the end of 2017 for Milan, even after Gattuso had taken charge, was pretty grim. But this will obviously not sit well. I mean, he's a blood and thunder type of manager, and I was going to say I would expect some of that from him, but actually I don't know if I would, because he's also got a very good rapport with that team. He's got a real bond that he's developed in a short space of time with the young players in that team, and I can half imagine actually his response to something as emphatic as this being a recognition that there's no point hammering the players and you're better off to put an arm around them and say, hey, it's okay, guys, we can still take steps forward from here. But I think the greater issue for Milan in terms of this tie is that I just don't necessarily believe we've yet seen, even in this 13 game unbeaten run, anything to indicate that Gattuso is the sort of master tactician who can develop a game plan, who can find a way out of a hole like this. I think his success has been built broadly on two things. First of which is just simply finding a consistent starting 11, which is something that Vincenzo Montella singularly failed to do before him. I don't think Milan started the same team in any two consecutive games under Montella this season. So that was a big part of it. And then the second part of it was just sort of getting everyone doing their jobs, as mundane as that sounds. I think at the beginning of the season, you had guys like Leonardo Bonucci, big signing obviously over the summer, who was trying to do everything, who was trying to play centre back, be the captain of the team, and also be the playmaker all the time and sort of step forward and start attacks and just generally do too much. And now that he's got back to just being a ball playing centre back, but a centre back and doing that first and foremost, you've seen his performances have improved. A few sort of smart selection decisions on top of that, including letting Patrick Cutrone be the regular starter up front, because he frankly has just been outperforming the two guys they signed, Nikola Kalinic and Andre Silva. Although, having said that, with hindsight, Cutrone, I think, was the wrong guy for the game tonight, because there were times in that first half where Milan desperately needed to hold the ball up, and that's not really his game. He's a get onto the end of cross in the box kind of striker, not a slow the game down and look after possession striker. So I think Gattuso has made some real gains through relatively simple steps. And I think that there's, that was what Milan needed. But I also think that the jury is still out, despite the 13 game unbeaten run, on whether he's going to be the manager again next season. I think it was always a let's get to the end of the season appointment. And at the moment, they're on course to get to the end of the season in much better shape than they were when he took over. But he's not secure in that job by any stretch. And I don't personally think he's a manager with the nous to turn around the situation. I should knock on some wood at this point, but to turn around the situation in this particular tie.
Yeah, I'm doing it for you. But look, it's beautifully set up for Arsenal. It's also set up for Gattuso, maybe to show us what he's made of as a manager.
Yes, having said all that, I should remind everyone that I didn't think Arsenal were going to win this first leg. So
hey, look,
we'll see. I've been wrong before.
none of us know anything. That's the great thing about football. None of us know a damn thing. But listen, it's been great talking to you as ever, Paolo. Thanks a million.
Anytime.
Thank you very much indeed to Paolo, always a good man for the Italian football for some reason. I can't quite figure out why, but you can find him on Twitter. He is at Paolo_Bandini. That is at Paolo_Bandini.
It's the history of the Tottenham. It's the history of the Tottenham. It's the history of the Tottenham. They miss always something. They concede many chances every game. Many chances every game. It's the history of the Tottenham. Tottenham, Tottenham. Tottenham. It's the history of the Tottenham.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If that reference has passed you by, it was, of course, Juventus captain Giorgio Chiellini talking about their win at Wembley in midweek against Tottenham in the Champions League. They were 1-0 down. They came back to win 2-1. And, of course, that's just kind of what they do because...
It's the history of the Tottenham.
It is indeed the history of the Tottenham, winning sweet fuck all. And they've done it again. Congratulations to them. It's a week for Italian manager soundbites. Of course, you've had the Gattuso thing this week.
Sometimes it may be good, sometimes it may be shit.
I think my new ambition in life is to get an interview with Gattuso and just to ask him, like, what's your favorite breakfast?
Sometimes maybe Cocoa Puffs, sometimes maybe muesli.
If you had to buy a chocolate bar, what would you buy?
Sometimes maybe Bounty, sometimes maybe Star Bar.
And what about your favorite aftershave?
Sometimes maybe Paco Rabanne. Sometimes maybe Izzy Miyake.
It would be amazing. I could just do it all day long. Maybe one day we'll make that happen. Right, let's move on and let's talk about fanzines and football fanzines, something I'm sure many of us are aware of. But the world is changing and things are changing for the people who produce fanzines as much as they're changing for everybody else. And with me to discuss all that is the editor of The Gooner, Kevin Witcher. Hi, Kevin, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Andrew.
I want to talk to you a bit about The Gooner. Gooner, obviously, anyone who's gone to a game will know what The Gooner is, but it is a fanzine that you can buy outside the ground packed full of Arsenal content. And we'll talk about the specifics of The Gooner now in a few minutes' time. But just in terms of perhaps for people who've never been to a game in England or who've never seen these things on sale, could you explain a little bit about what a fanzine is, where they came from, and where they sort of place themselves in the culture of English football?
Well, fanzines effectively started with punk rock, and it was a way of people who had no access to being able to express themselves through print media, basically doing it themselves, DIY. Mm. And that was sort of late 70s. And it, as time went on, it started to creep into football. So we had, in the mid 80s, we had general fanzines like When Saturday Comes and Off the Ball. And then people who supported individual clubs started their own. So it was a way of people writing about their football club and getting their opinion out there, and sometimes campaigning about stuff, which I had no real other avenues to do. So it's an early form of fan expression. Obviously, we see a great deal of that now, but it was the print version of that, and we started the Gooner in 1987, so we recently celebrated our 30th anniversary.
Well, happy birthday to you and all you guys and people who've contributed to that down the years. And you're right. I mean, I think people nowadays, they've grown up with blogs and fan opinion being easily accessible, but also being easy to create. Like, you don't have to. I mean, certainly when I started Arsblog, and that was over 16 years ago, it was a bit more difficult. Whereas now you could go to any of the blogging sites, put in a few clicks, choose a name, and up you go, and you're ready to go inside a minute. But when it came to fanzines, obviously the technology was different. The way you had to collate all the information and all the stories was different and get people together. There was, I guess, a sense of community in as much as we understand it online now with comment sections and all that kind of thing. But bringing people together to write about, particularly about a club that they love, you know, fan-specific ones, that must have been really exciting in a way.
Yes, I mean, it was a very social thing because the contributors used to actually meet up in the pub to, A, discuss what we were going to do in the issue, but obviously just talk about Arsenal as well. So yeah, there was a real sense of community. And I mean, the interesting thing now is because of the way technology's changed, most of my communication is actually done by email with the contributors, but it is always great when I do see them because we have a bond, and it goes back a long way with some of these guys.
So you started in what, 1987?
Yeah, and in just to put the story straight, the founder of the Gooner was Mike Francis. Mm-hmm. He was editing it for the first 13 years of his existence. I got involved after about 2 years, and I started getting involved in the sales and distribution and writing a bit. And in 2000, basically, Mike was so busy with his day job that he handed over the editing to me, and I've been doing it for the last, 18 years now.
It's a labor of love in many ways, you would say, like lots of things, but there were others. I mean, the Gooner was not the only Arsenal fanzine out there, was it? I think there was Up the Arse as well, Highbury High. Mm.
1-0 down, 2-1 up.
Yeah.
It was long running. And Gunflash
yeah.
magazine, which they now classify themselves as a fanzine, but in fact they started just after World War II. So they were actually the forerunners of all of us, but it doesn't have quite the same irreverent feel as the fanzines did, certainly in their early years.
And that was, I guess, in many ways the appeal of fanzines. Certainly I know that from Arsblog down the years, what people have enjoyed and connected with is the fact that it can be irreverent. It is the opinion of one guy. And of course, in a fanzine, you've got the opinion of many different guys and girls who are writing for these things. But you do have that freedom of expression that you don't get necessarily in the bigger platforms or in the mainstream media, for example, that you can do things, you can say things that perhaps sometimes will go beyond the line. But that's part of the beauty of it.
Yes, I mean, the only censorship we do is basically certain words. There's one you used to use that begins with C, which I think even you stop using now, which we always asterisk that one.
I use it a bit more judiciously now, that's the
and obviously things like, in the early days, to our shame, we used to use the Y word, you know, which was very much part of fan culture, but our education process now makes most of us understand that actually that word isn't the right way to go. So we don't touch that anymore. So, you know, we've become enlightened along the way. But yes, there's still a lot of humor and, basically piss-taking, for want of a better phrase, which has always been a hugely enjoyable part of what we do.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you have to have it as well, don't you? Because throughout the 30-year existence of the Gunner, there have been ups and downs for Arsenal. And I think in recent times, we've been relatively lucky in terms of what we've achieved as a club. But in order to deal with some of the disappointment, in order to deal with some of the disheartening results and everything else, you do need to remember that there's humour in it, that there is there are people out there who will connect with that. It's a coping mechanism as much as anything.
Absolutely right. And one of the favourite parts of the fanzine for a lot of people is what we do on the back cover, because most issues will do some kind of spoof. And depending on how well Arsenal doing, sometimes the subject matter is us, and sometimes it's other teams, such as Spurs, Chelsea, Man United, etc. So, humour is so critical to the enjoyment of football. I can't imagine the sport without it.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's hard to find, it's fair to say.
But there's always gallows humour, Andrew, always gallows humour.
Oh, listen, tell me about it. Tell me about it. I'm having to deal in that an awful lot at this moment in time, but that's neither here nor there. But and it's also a great way for people, in the same way that blogs are now, for people to perhaps start a career or to branch out or to get their voice out there. Fanzines were a way for people to have their writing published, and also I guess judged is not quite the right word, but you know, if you had a writer who was popular, people would tell you that, and it was a good way for them to sort of start building their careers as writers.
Well, I mean, the most obvious example of that is someone like Amy Lawrence, who used to write for us. But also more recently, people like Tim Stillman started in the Gooner and have grown. And obviously now he's writing for Your Good Self as well as many other places. And someone like a journalist like Laith Yusuf, who regularly writes for, I think, The Mail and The Standard online. He basically started getting his Arsenal work published in the Gooner, and has always said he owes us a debt of gratitude, which I'm not so sure about, but it's nice when people say that. So I think a lot of the time it also depends on the writer's own position, because some of these guys have got very good jobs and they don't even need to think about making a living from writing. So they just do it for the enjoyment and to express themselves without needing to take it any further, although some of them are very talented writers and could easily do so.
Mm. What has been your favourite part of being the editor of the Gooner over the, how many, since 2000 when you took it over? So 18 years. Obviously, your involvement stretches back further than that. But, you know, looking back on those 30 years, what's been your one takeaway from it?
Well, I mean, writing about the good times is great. But, you know, even the bad times, it is a cathartic process just expressing your feelings about things when they haven't gone right. So, you know, the process, for example, of writing about the defeat in Paris in 2006 was actually very helpful for me, because it was a depressing evening, but I came to terms with it just through writing about it afterwards. So I just think, you know, as a sort of process for the benefit of my mental health, and football can drive you nuts, it's helped a lot.
Yeah. Again, I know that feeling. You know, there is, when you have to sit down and think about something in a kind of rational way, it does help you come to terms with it. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not sure, but maybe it's kept me sane as well. But like many publications, and even something like Arsblog, which has had to change and metamorphosize over the years, technology has played a part in what's going on at the Gooner right now. And this was supposed to be your last season producing a physical product. But there's been such a demand for it. I think perhaps you could liken it to the reemergence of vinyl, something like that, a medium or a platform that many people thought was gone and dead and buried. People still like to have a physical product in their hands. Yes, you can get it on your phone and you can get it on your tablet or on your computer and everything else, but there is something about having a stack of fanzines or a stack of comics or records or whatever it might be. So you're looking to maybe do something a bit different.
Yes, we've got to change the model of how we operate if we're going to survive, basically. I mean, for all our lifetime, as it were, of the fanzine, we've relied on selling match days. But the to what it was when we started out. And so effectively what's happened is the people who love it have convinced me that it would I should try and keep it going. And I do enjoy doing it. So I thought, well, okay, let's have a look at it. And we came up with this idea of understanding that it's a niche publication. There's a limited number of buyers, but there's got to be enough. So we've started a campaign where by next season, if we get 1,000 subscribers who can commit in advance for the whole season, we'll publish next season and we'll go on a year-by-year basis as long as there's interest for it. There will still be a very minimal sales operation. So, for example, people who go home and especially away will be aware of a guy called Alex, who's like a legendary seller. Mm. And almost part of the reason I'm trying this is because I don't know what he'd do if he didn't have the gimmick to sell, especially at the away games. But what I will say is that the people who do decide to pick it up on match day, if enough of you don't commit in advance, we just won't be there to buy. So for that reason, what I'm offering is effectively the thing dropping through your door rather than you needing to buy it on the match day. And that secures us and makes sure we're viable. And there'll be a few knocking around for people who decide not to subscribe, but I wouldn't rely on it.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously are having to be pretty exact when it comes to your print runs and your margins and everything else. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's the way the world is going. But if people want to find out more about this or how they can subscribe, I mean, how many issues do they get if they do subscribe?
What they get is they'll get 6 issues a season sent to them. And what we need to do is we need to increase the cover price. Now, it'll go up from £3 to £5. However, we're also increasing the number of pages to 64 pages. Currently, it's 48. So, you know, the way I look at that is you have to pay more than £30 if you're going to go on Sunday and get the cheapest adult lower seat to watch Arsenal play Watford.
Yeah. Now,
90 minutes you're going to get for that. Compare that with receiving 6 times 64-page issues about Arsenal every season with content that's quite mixed and plenty of nostalgia. And the one thing I do appreciate is that this is going to appeal to people of a certain generation. So, you know, in all honesty, if there's anyone under 35 who wants to subscribe, it's brilliant. But we're really looking at the kind of 35 to sort of OAP age group as the people who still like to read magazines. That's their preferred format. And they'll relate much better to the nostalgic content. The other thing to mention when people do sort of look up the details of what we're doing, we will have an offer to send anyone who wants to see an issue this season as a sample. They can buy one for 50 pence. And that's just to cover the postage. We'll send one out to them. It's UK only because the cost of sending anything abroad is quite oppressive. But hopefully there's enough Arsenal fans in the UK or Arseblog listeners who are tempted to at least have a look for 50p, see what it's about, see what it's like. And if they like it, they can subscribe as well.
All right. Well, look, I wish you the very best of luck with it because it sounds like a great project. And I think in this day and age, all of us really need to support small niche publishers. I think we all do that in our own way. And certainly I've been very grateful for people supporting Arseblog over the last number of weeks as well. So the best of luck with it. And people can get all the details on the website, which is onlinegooner.com.
Exactly right. So if you just visit the homepage, there'll be an article there, probably titled Save the Gooner, and that'll have all the details contained within.
All right.
So many thanks to you, Andrew, for just helping out with the campaign and giving us a bit of oxygen.
My pleasure, and let's hope the football gets good between now and the end of the season as well. That might help a bit.
That certainly would. Thank you very much.
So there you go. Two of my favourite Arsenal writers, Amy and Tim, began their writing careers with the Gooner. And who knows in the future what kind of talent might emerge from the pages of that fanzine if it continues. And if it's something that interests you and if it's something that you feel like you want to support, get all the details at onlinegooner.com. Right, there's not a huge amount to say about the game on Sunday because we've just finished the game tonight and it's very difficult to know anything about team news. There were obviously a couple of injuries. Kolasinac went off, Chambers went off. We'll have to see if anybody else picked up a knock along the way. Fingers crossed they haven't. Of course, we've got Aubameyang available at the weekend as well. There is some revenge required against this Watford team. I want us to score lots of goals, and I'd like us to dance in a circle around Troy Deeney, giving him the fingers, going, then, up yours, you fat cunt. I would like a bit of that. If we can have some of that, just to add to the fun we've already had tonight, that would be a great thing. I think we all need it. We all deserve it after what's happened over the last few weeks, so fingers crossed that's exactly what we'll get. Have yourselves a great weekend. Remember, there's lots of stuff to listen to in our podcast archives, and also, on our Patreon page, James and I did the very first Arseblog Gunnerblog phone-in show. You can subscribe to that for just €5 a month, plus VAT. There's also an Invincible special. There's an interview with Tim Wheeler. I've got lots of cool people coming up to interview for that My Arse podcast. We're going to have more history podcasts, more written content. You can get all that on the Patreon site, patreon.com/Arseblog. And it does help support everything else that we do here and everything that we will do in the future. So, look, hopefully we're on the right track. We're on the upward trajectory now. We've won away from home. It was a good win, a confidence-boosting win. Let's take it from here, see if we can beat Watford, and then who knows? The world is our very oyster. Thank you, as ever, for listening. If you'd like to give us a review on iTunes, that would be great. If you don't want to, that's fine as well. I hope you have a great weekend. I hope we smash Watford, and James and I will be here on Monday with an Arsecast Extra for you as well. Until then, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Sometimes the truth is harder than the pain inside. Yeah. Ooh. Sometimes. I'm only just beginning to see the real you. And sometimes when we touch, the honesty is too much. And I think it takes more than addiction there.
Sometimes.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.